B-Pod Studios.
This is Talkin' Rock.
Talkin' Rock.
Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Back at it for another non-award-winning episode of the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Just like last week's Blackie Lawless episode. Non-award-winning, but lots of listens. Thank you guys so much for checking it out. And got to thank the Wasp folks for sharing it, and Blabbermouth for picking it up and all that kind of stuff. Blackie was fun to talk to. Really one of my bucket list guests. I was thinking about that earlier today. There's a few bands. It's funny. Kix. I've never interviewed. I don't even know if I've ever seen anyone for the band Kix. Remember those guys from Baltimore? Anyhow, just one of the bands I was thinking of today that I've never had a chance to talk to. But today is kind of similar. Joe Bouchard, formerly from Blue Oyster Cult, one of the, one of the original members. He wasn't there at the very, very beginning, but he was there for the meat of their success, is coming up first. And then Mike Kennelly, he played with Frank Zappa from 1987 till his death in 1994. And now he's going out with this Zappa band tour, which sounds really interesting. And, man, I've just become a big Zappa fan after getting back into vinyl about 5 years ago. I think I got about four of his albums. I got to get some more. But you find a Zappa record, and sometimes they're a little bit pricey. And it's like, do I buy a record for $30 or do I buy three of these over here for less? Anyways, we'll talk with Mike coming up here in just a bit. Joe Bouchard is up first. Album, American Rocker, drops on June the 3rd. Never had a chance to talk or meet Joe, but man, he was awesome to talk with. And he is fired up about his new album.
I'm excited about the new album. I get compliments from people every day. You know, wow, that sounds so good, man. Your voice sounds great.
I was going to say, you're
pretty
still
good for an old guy.
I was going to say, yeah, still fired up to put out new music at this stage of the game, yeah. Huh?
I don't know how it happened. I mean, it was just, and I was just going through a list of what I had at the beginning, and it was pretty thin. There was not much there. So it all happened. You know, this is really my pandemic album.
Okay.
So schedules cleared out, got nowhere to go, stuck here at home, you know. I got some nice guitars back there.
I see that. Yeah, that's cool.
Got to make them work. So got to justify my guitar habit.
Yeah, we all have some sort of habit.
My guitar habit. You know, I have to feed that.
Yeah, no doubt.
So it just rolled out. It just seemed to roll out. There were a few ideas that I had from previous years, but most of it is brand new. So it was exciting for me. And then it just, you know, conceptually it sort of came together. I know everybody was feeling down about the pandemic and everything, but I was feeling pretty up when I sort of look at the fantastic things that have happened in my life, you know. So the theme of this album is the great days of the 70s.
Well, those were
nothing
good days
like
for
them.
You.
Yeah, there was nothing like them. You know?
Yeah, well, especially in your life. I mean, you know, the first single, My Way is the Highway, a typical tour song right there.
Tour song, yeah, it was a tour song.
Yeah.
And I would think, you know, I never used to think that I would write something like that, but you know, I think about these guys, they're sitting on the tour bus, you know, they got nothing to do, they're, you know, and so they crank out a tour song. But I don't know, felt good to me, you know, and I got Mickey Curry to play drums on it.
Yeah,
he's an incredible drummer. And then after it was all done, I thought, oh, this is great. My brother gets involved in it, and he says, you know, it needs something. So I send him the tracks, and he's doing it at home. He comes up with this great cowbell part.
Of course he did.
Why not?
Right.
And then I send it to Mickey. I said, Mickey, what do you think of this track? And he says, that cowbell part is killing.
You
can't get away from it. Oh, my God.
That is hysterical. I'm sure you've been asked about that a million times, but I mean, that must have, I mean, you were already out of the band by the time that skit happened, but I mean, that pushes you right back into the spotlight. Talk about that scene.
Well, you know, you know, we had the song. I truly believed it's going to be a hit song. I didn't think it was going to become the iconic thing that it is today, but I knew it had the best chance of anything we ever recorded. And so we got to the end of the recording, and we're sitting in the studio, and there's one track left on the tape. This is the days of analog tape, you know. 24 track, one track left. What are we going to do on that one track? Well, how about some percussion, you know? And David Lucas, who was a co-producer on that record, said, I think it needs a cowbell.
So that's exactly what happened.
So he says, Albert, go out there. I mean, Eric thought he played it. David thought he played it. I mean, you know, it was a long time ago. So, you know, the memory. But I was a witness. And I was sitting there on the couch in the control room, and I'm looking, and I'm saying, don't screw this up. Albert, you better get it right. So he went out in the studio, and I'm kind of on the edge of my seat, you know. Oh, my God, it sounds so good. You know, why is he doing it? And then he played it perfect. One take, perfect.
Is that
perfect.
Right?
Then everybody goes home. 2 weeks later, it's all mixed. And then I really started, the hair started, you know, lifting on the back of my neck, you know, and listening to this mix. And there's a couple of moments in the mix that really, really rivet me. What can I say, you know? And I'm sure everybody has their little thing. But that's the beauty of a beautifully produced, beautifully mixed hit song, you know? And people can relate to it. They had their stories about it. You know, goes through the generations too.
So. Yeah. Did you know that this skit was coming up? Did anyone tell you about it?
No. In fact, I missed it the first time.
Okay.
I caught it the second time in a rerun, and of course they taped it. You know, and then you know you can see it everywhere now. But I missed it. My friend Dennis Dunaway.
Yeah.
My bass playing friend from Alice Cooper, yeah. He tried to call me, but it was in the days of dial up and I was on the internet. So he just got a busy signal. And he was watching it live. He watched it live with his daughters.
Yeah.
His daughters, you know, because I used to go over at Dennis's house and it would be like, oh, it's just another friend of dad's, you know, who comes over, you know. And, but after that skit, all of a sudden, I became a celebrity in the Dunaway household. Whoa! He was played by Horatio Sands. Wow! So anyway, yeah, it was all good.
No, that's great. Good. Yeah, Dennis actually has been in this very studio with me a couple times.
Oh,
so
yeah,
great guy. Yeah, I like
great
him.
Guy. I've been working with him forever. We're going to going on a little tour in July. We have another CD and a DVD coming out with some animation on it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the new record, American Rocker, that drops on June the 3rd. And talk about some of these.
Soon.
Yeah, so you're saying this is your pandemic record. I see some of the songs. Well, also you say it's about the 70s, like in the golden age. There's a song Deadly Kisses, Love Out of Thin Air. Talk about some of the some of the songs on here.
Well, let's see. They're all good. In the Golden Age, of course, is definitely relates to the tour and the band. Deadly Kisses goes way back to the early days of my romantic life. Maybe high school. Let's just say high school. Love Out of Thin Air. That was just one of those songs that just felt really good. And that's more contemporary. Off-Season Hotel, though, is a cool one because it relates to two different stories. I put two stories together. Back in the 60s, 67, 68, I was the band leader in a resort. I was the house band at the Thousand Islands Club.
Really?
And it was a fantastic summer. They paid us. They all paid us a lot of money. We got free food, free room, board, and we were the house band. We worked 6 nights a week, 4 hours a night. It was fantastic. You know, the end of the summer comes and you have that big Labor Day party. You know what I mean?
Yep.
The big Labor Day party. Yep. And so all we're all having a great time, you know. And then, like, the week after Labor Day, everything's gone. It's, like, empty, you know. And you get in all the staff, all of our friends, they drive down to Florida and do the whole thing again, you know, doing the winter months in Florida in hotels down there. So it was kind of an interesting summer, really amazing summer. And then about 30 years later, I get a call from my brother. He says, how'd you like to go to Florida to do a gig? And it's going to be for the Ghost Hunters. You know, did you ever see the Ghost Hunters on TV?
Yeah.
It was those guys that go and look for ghosts in different buildings. So anyway, they were having a convention. And our friend Peter Robbins, who studies UFOs, you know, he's written a couple of books on UFOs. He was going to be one of the guest speakers. And Linda Blair from The Exorcist was one of the speakers. And the guys from Ghost Hunters. So we go down there, we play our set, you know, having fun, playing Reaper and all of those, you know, good scary songs. And then I'm sitting in the bar and I see all these TV monitors. And what's all the TV monitors? Well, they're having a ghost hunt in the attic of the hotel. It's the oldest wooden structure in Florida. Huge, huge hotel. So we're sitting there in the bar just hanging out. And this nice woman comes over. Hey, you want to go on a ghost hunt? Sure, why not? You know? And so they give us night vision goggles and these listening devices. So we go up to the attic of this old hotel, and she's giving us a tour. And like I said, do you hear that? You couldn't hear anything. but no, you can hear it. It sounds like, So, well, I don't know. Maybe I heard it. I wasn't sure, you know. And anyway, we were up there for 2 hours.
Oh, jeez.
Looking for ghosts.
So you didn't see anything?
In the attic of this. Didn't see anything.
Well,
I mean, I don't think I saw anything. But what an experience. So anyway, I put those two stories together of you know, what it was like to be in the hotel off-season, you know, and all of the ghosts that are in those old resorts, you know. You never know.
No, and you know, it's funny you mentioned
maybe
that.
Maybe we were too scary. We scared away the ghosts.
Yeah, right. But it's funny that you mentioned those. So you were working in this, you were with this band in New York, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you grew up, so I grew up outside of Buffalo. I grew up in Western New York, yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in upstate New York, way up by the Thousand Islands.
Right.
On the St. Lawrence River and that area, right on the edge of Canada.
Yeah, and what you were saying about, so like, you know, the Labor Day weekend, it's like, you're right, because after that Labor Day weekend, things up north kind of shut down. The kids go back to school. The weather changes almost overnight, and that's
right.
It, you know?
Yeah.
But you were
that all together in one song.
Yeah, you were talking about earlier how, you know, you said that you've had some really good times, and, you know, was playing in a band with your brother for all those years, would that has to be up near the top, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought maybe if we lasted 3 years, that would be great. That would be a success, you know? And, you know, so we started touring, and I don't know, one thing just seemed to fall after another. But finally, you get to the point where you get to play Madison Square Garden.
Mm.
And we played there 3 times, played there with Rod Stewart and the Faces, and then we played there with Black Sabbath, and then we played there with Foghat, and we were the headliners.
Mm.
So, you know, it was you know, but... And then, you know, as soon as Reaper became a hit, we started playing stadiums. You know, we got to play the big stadium, the Texas Jam. We got to play, you know, the Day on the Green for for Bill Graham, and you know, in San Francisco, and in the right outside of San Francisco, it was, you know, Winterland. We played Winterland. It was so great, you know. So many of those, and the festivals in Europe and France and Germany, and you know, 20,000, 30,000 people.
That Sabbath tour, that was the Black and Blue tour, right?
Yeah,
that's a little bit before me. I got into rock and roll like the early 80s, but yeah, that's a famous tour.
That was, 1980. That was 1980.
Okay, yeah, just, yeah.
And I'm trying to think our manager was managing Black Sabbath at the time. And then the really strange, but Ronnie Dio, who I knew from high school, he's from upstate New York.
Yeah, you went to school with Ronnie Dio?
Well, he was in Cortland.
Cortland, right.
And I went to college at Ithaca.
Okay.
I was a music student at Ithaca. And so he would play in Ithaca all the time. And I saw him play up in Watertown, New York.
Did you see Elf?
Ronnie Dio and the Prophets.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, you know, he made the right choices, because he worked with Rainbow and had a band called Elf.
Yep.
And Electric Elves. And so it was really kind of cool that he was singing with Black Sabbath on that tour.
Yeah, Ronnie's always been one of my favorites. Plus, at 5'6", he's one of the few guys I'm taller than. So,
we're about the same size, so we could relate. We could relate.
Yeah, Ronnie was great. I see. You know, it was funny. Obviously, I didn't know this was going to happen, but I see you got that amp behind you, that Marshall amp. And I just watched Spinal Tap with my neighbors last night. They'd never seen it before. And I'm like, you got to watch this movie.
And there's going to be a new one. I can't believe it.
Yeah, man.
That's funny.
I was just talking about this.
I lived Spinal Tap.
That's the first time
I saw it. Dennis Dunaway took me to the movie theater.
Yeah.
Says, you got to see this movie. Everybody's talking about this movie. So I went, and I thought it was like a sad drama. I didn't get any of the jokes. I just said, oh, no, it's my life. The props that didn't work. The shows that got canceled. In fact, we got canceled in Memphis, which is part of this story. And like, how did they get that? We were canceled in Memphis. We went to go to see, well, we got a day off in Memphis. Mm. It's not that bad. So we say, we're going to go to Graceland. Let's go to Graceland. And it was canceled. It was closed. It was closed for renovations. So we didn't even get to cry at the cemetery.
Or do the Heartbreak Hotel.
But it was
so much
like what happened to us.
Yeah.
You know, and the road crews are crazy, you know, and the drums, you know, the drummers that would, you know, self-destruct.
Yeah, every band has them.
To this day, it is still one of my favorite movies, and I'll probably watch it 15 times.
Yeah, it's such a classic.
I probably watched it 15 times. I got actually some outtakes that nobody's ever seen, and I can't say where I got them.
Really?
It's real. Yeah. How did I get them? My brother gave them to me, and he met somebody who had them. And there's like whole characters that are in the outtakes that didn't appear in the movie. So who knows? Maybe they'll show up in the sequel.
Boy, I hope the sequel's good, because there's been some pretty bad sequels in our lifetime.
Oh, I know. Yes. Yes, I know. But I think I like the idea of the story where the manager who dies, his wife gets a contract that says they have to play one last concert. So you can imagine these old guys. Did you see Breaking? Or no, what was it? Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul.
Yeah, I'm on the first episode of this season.
And David St. Hubbins.
Oh, yeah.
Actually plays the old lawyer.
His brother,
it's kind of tragic and sad.
Yeah.
Really sad. So anyway, but So he'll be back, but he'll be this older character. And they have to put on the show, you know, because they have the reputation. You know, they have to keep up their reputation.
Now, what movie was this is a really bad mind fart on myself. But what was the movie that you guys were in with the lasers?
Oh, yeah. Stoned Age.
Yeah, Stoned Age. Yeah,
the
yeah, yeah.
Stoned Age.
Yeah, because, yeah, you know, somebody was... just had a laser mishap over the weekend. Ivan Moody from Five Finger Death Punch, he said to have an eye patch put on because apparently he tripped over a laser
really?
Or something. Yeah, and of course,
over a laser?
Yeah, in the story, Blue Oyster Cult was actually brought up as well, so.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you got me. We pioneered, you know, lasers. I mean, there were, you know, Zeppelin had one. I think McCartney had one. But we were the third.
Yeah.
Say, you know, we saw Zeppelin's lasers and said, we got to have those, you know. And so we had this great laser show, took it around for about 2 years. And it was fantastic. It, you know, ZZ Top wouldn't play with us because... They would say, how can we follow Star Wars? They were complaining that they had to follow Star Wars because it was so intense. You know, it was great, you know. I mean, it was great to be on top like that and spending huge amounts of money on these laser shows. And then the government started saying, how can they do that? And they started following us around. They sent out a team of scientists, you know, in the white coats.
Really?
And they would make measurements every night, and they would quiz the laser operator because there were things that we were doing that the military didn't even have.
Mm.
You know, wow. Eric had this trick bracelet. He had this trick bracelet, and it had a fiber optic cable. So the fiber optic cable would go back to the laser, and then the laser would shoot out of his hand. It was incredible. And then they pointed at a mirror ball, and then the pyrotechnician had this exploding thing underneath the mirror ball, you know, and he would just hit it with that laser, and it would blow up. And these scientists, they would get out of the way and hide because they figured they're going to blow up. But, you know, it was that crazy road crew that we had. They loved to push in the envelope, you know, as far as they could. And then the government made us change them, and it wasn't as good, so we dropped them.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. So that was back in the days of Kiss and Alice Cooper, and you had to have like some sort of stage.
You had to have something, you know.
Yeah.
And people, you know, it wasn't like today where you can see everything on video.
Right.
Usually the next day, you know. You miss the concert, go see it on video on the next day. But back then you had to go to the show, and there was, a lot of competition, you know. We learned a lot from Alice Cooper. Alice, the opening act for our first successful tour was with Alice Cooper. Mm. And the greatest guys, and we really learned a lot how to put on a good show and how to put on, you know, entertain the public and, you know, and also have great music at the same time.
Was that with the Alice Cooper Band, or was it Alice Cooper? Was Dennis still
the
with
the Alice yeah. Cooper Band, 1972.
Yeah.
And also we did a few more shows in 1973. But we had done a tour before that with the Byrds, and everybody, you know, they loved the Byrds, and we loved the Byrds. But, you know, the crowd wanted to hear Mr. Tambourine Man and not Cities on Flame with Rock and Roll.
One of my favorites, by the way. I love that song.
Oh, first album, lots of good stuff there.
Yeah, that's so good. Yeah, no doubt about it. Hey, real fast before we close out here, I just wanted to ask you about, I just happened to think about this as I was getting ready to talk to you. Metallica covered Astronomy, and what were your thoughts when a band that big covers a song like that?
It was huge. I was working in a publishing company. I'd left the band. You know, played in a bunch of other bands. I got to play with Spencer Davis. As a keyboard player. Mm. You know, I went from a bass player to a keyboard player. But So things were, you know, it's the mid-90s. Things are not, you know, it's more grunge than classic rock at that time. So Metallica is doing this album of covers. And I found out they were going to do a Blue Oyster Cult song. So that's cool. They'll probably do one of the usuals. Mm. No, they're doing astronomy. I'm like, whoa! I quit my day job. First thing I did was quit my day job. And it told me that I really had to play. You know, I had to really get serious about writing songs, because that's the thing, and it still carries with me to this day. That cover just changed my life. I mean, it was a co-write with my brother and our manager Sandy Perlman, but they did really well, and they sold 5 million CDs. Mm. And I only get a penny, but those pennies add up.
Yeah, no doubt. Metallica's made a few pennies. There's no question.
That pays for some of these guitars.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So the new record, American Rocker, comes out June 3rd. And American Rocker, that's just you.
Yeah. This is the most me of any record I've ever done. I think when, you know, I was just sort of getting my footing. This is my 7th solo album. Mm. So the first couple, I was just sort of figuring out what to do. I had some people that wrote songs for me that were amazing. I love the material there. And then Blue Oyster Cult, I knew Blue Oyster Cult was putting out a new album. So I sent them some songs. They didn't want to use them, so I put them on my last record. Mm. This one, Blue Oyster Cult isn't putting out anything new at this point. I'm sort of competing with my brother because he's put out... He's working on his third double album right now.
Wow.
The Imaginos. It's a three album set of double albums. Mm. It's incredible. It's heavy. It's heavy. It's very heavy. And I love what he's doing with it. And I play in his band. He plays in my band. But this solo album coming out, American Rocker, is more me. I wrote every bit of the music. There's only two songs that I have outside lyrics from. So I wrote a lot of lyrics, you know, it's making me feel good, you know, just getting a good response on the singles so far. And, I think it's going to do very, very well.
What is your relationship? You're standing right now at the BOC guys. I wasn't sure if you talked to them or how that works.
Yeah, we're pretty good. You know, Albert does more with them than I do. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm pretty good relationship. I sat in with them on Halloween 2 years ago, and that was a lot of fun. I had done a few others. We did a whole tribute to our keyboard player Alan Lanier, who passed away. So we did a set at BB King's in New York, and did a whole set of Alan Lanier songs that had never been played on stage. He wasn't a strong singer, but he wrote some great songs. Mm. So after he passed away, we decided that we were going to do a whole set of Alan stuff. And it was fantastic. You know, it's just a matter of like, why didn't we do these songs back in the day, you know? Mm. But I think that was kind of the strength of Blue Oyster Cult. Is we had a good team of songwriters, you know, and lyric people that helped us. It was a very, very strong, lucky bunch of guys, you know, you know, we all loved what we did. And so I'm pretty good relationship with the guys. They have a touring band that's been pretty well seasoned by now. Mm. The guy who plays me is, Danny Miranda, who got to play with Queen. He played with Queen on the Paul Rodgers tour.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So he's a heck of a player. Mm. And they're doing very well. You know, they're not playing as many shows they used to, but it's all good. It's all good.
Now, you're going to play some shows coming up here. You only have a few, but are they overseas primarily?
Yeah. We're starting in Scotland two shows in Scotland. Then we go to England for six more shows. And now I've just heard that we're going to France and playing in Paris, and we're doing a festival in the south of France.
Really?
And this is the Bouchard Brothers band, which is just three-piece. It's mostly acoustic. We do the, you know, some of the hits, but we also go deep into Albert's catalog and my catalog, and there's a lot of music there. So we are really looking forward to that. If it goes well, we'll be back. We'll be back for more. We'll be in your neighborhood.
I was just going to say, when you come to Detroit, you got to meet up for sure. But yeah, it's like this music business, you know, you got some guitars, you got some amps, and you get to travel the world. So
yeah. Yeah. I love it. I can't believe it. It's still very much a part of me. And anyway, yeah.
Well Joe, appreciate your time. American Rocker on June 3rd. It's been really great talking to you. And man, what a great history you have in continued success.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Great talking to you.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Next, another first-time installment, the debut voyage of this guy, Micah Kennelly, from the Frank Zappa Band. And Mike has a really interesting story about joining Frank Zappa. Talks about this upcoming tour, talks about whether or not his sons are involved in this, and just pretty much the world of Frank Zappa. I did ask him about the documentary. It's been so long since I watched it, but he was like, yeah, I was in it. I'm like, yeah, well, of course you were. But it's been a while since I've watched that. But Mike, just a really great to talk to, super interesting, and man, just a talented guy today on Talkin' Rock. We started off by talking about his favorite Zappa album.
A favorite album? We're Only It for the Money is my favorite.
Okay. All right, I got to get more on vinyl, so I've got Apostrophe, and I've got a couple others as well, but yeah, Apostrophe is another great one, too. So, hey, my first, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, I'm just agreeing with you. It's a great record.
Yeah. My first question I want to ask you is, how does somebody go about being asked to join the Frank Zappa Band?
I think Frank came by his musicians in a variety of ways. My particular way, which was completely out of left field, and I still can't believe it worked, was to call his office and ask for a job.
Really?
Yeah. But he had always claimed in interviews, and you know, sometimes you read these things and it sounds like, oh, he's paying lip service, it can't be true, but he had always said that his was the only sort of world-class touring band, like internationally known touring band, that anybody could get in if they could cut the gig. You know, it's most bands were about who you know, and you know, it's like nobody, you weren't just going to call up Led Zeppelin and say, yeah, hire me. But in the case of Zappa's band, it was the skill set required to play his stuff was so specific that if there was anybody that could play it, he wanted to know about it. So it just so happened that the moment that I called saying, "Hey, I play guitar and keyboards and I sing and I know all of Frank's stuff and I've taught myself how to play a bunch of it and I don't know if he's looking for anybody, but here I am." It just so happened that he was looking for people. And it's, you know, my timing was just fortuitous. If I'd waited a week to call, then you know, I wouldn't be talking to you now. So I'm just glad things went down the way they did.
So how do you find Frank's management and get a connection in 1987? I mean, today in the world of the internet, it's a lot different. But were you living in the area? Did you know people?
No, I took a leap, you know, because he had he had an office, you know, a business office. And they had a hotline, which was 818 Pumpkin. Oh. And I was a huge Zappa freak from the time I was 9 years old. It's like I loved Zappa music to more than any other. So I was obsessed. So I would call this hotline every week just to find out what was new with Frank. And it just so happened that one week when I called, there was an outgoing message. If you called after office hours, there was an outgoing message. And I heard the message that said, "For those of you who have heard the rumors, they're true. Frank is in rehearsal with a new band." And that was huge news because he did a tour in 1984. And after that tour, he swore he was never going to go on the road again. He was losing too much money. He had gotten this new computer musical instrument called a synclavier that allowed him to compose music in his basement and hear it performed by the computer exactly the way he wrote it. So it never made mistakes. It never showed up late for rehearsal. It didn't do drugs. You know, it was an extremely dependable machine, but it also wasn't as much fun as a band. It couldn't improvise. It was never spontaneous. It couldn't make you laugh by changing the lyrics to a song all of a sudden the way Ike Willis could. So after, a couple of years of this, he was just missing the camaraderie of a band, I think. And so, he was back in rehearsal with a new group. And my initial thought was, oh, cool, I get to see another tour. But then I just decided to get a little more ambitious and take the chance of calling during business hours and just alert them to the fact that I existed. So that's what I did. I called the next day. A guy named Jerry Fialka answered the phone, who worked at the office, who I'm extremely grateful to until this day, because he believed me when I said, yeah, I play guitar and keyboard and I sing. And I've taught myself to play a ton of Zappa music, and I'm familiar with all of it because I'm a freak who's just hardcore, and I listen to it all the time. And he passed the word on to Frank. And like I say, the timing was just good because Frank was looking for a guitarist who could sing, and he was looking for a keyboard player. And I think he thought it was going to have to be two different guys, but it turned out that some dude called his office unexpectedly claiming to be able to do it all. So Frank called me himself the next day and said, You can play all my music? And I said, well, I'm familiar with all of it, and I've taught myself to play a bunch of it. And he said, do you know how many songs that is? And I said, yeah, they're all in the next room. And he said, oh, I don't believe you. Get your ass up here and prove it. So that's what I did.
So do you remember the first time you met Frank in person? Was that it?
Yeah, it was at that audition. I was living in San Diego. The audition was in L.A. So my brother drove me up while I sat in the back of the car with the guitar, trying to play every Frank Zappa song in a 3-hour car ride. And then I walked in the room holding the guitar, like some the guy who was just like busking on the street corner. And Frank looked up and saw me walk in holding this guitar, and he goes, hey, nice case. and then he just had me plug in, and he had told me a couple of songs on the phone that he wanted me to learn. So I played those for him, and then he just started naming songs, he wanted to test what I had claimed on the phone, which was that his music just lived inside my head nonstop. And the best way I could think to describe it is that there's a Zappa jukebox in my head that, if he named a song, I would just push the button on the jukebox and play along with it. And so he got a kick out of that. He saw that there was a resource there that he could use because he wanted to, he had an idea for a larger band, and he wanted the band to have a large repertoire of different kinds of music it could play. And, if he named a song, I would play it for him. So, at the end of the rehearsal, he shook my hand and said, at the end of the audition, I should say, he shook my hand and said, well, come back on Monday so the rest of the band can witness your particular splendor, which is a verbatim quote because, I'll never forget the fact that he actually said that. So then I had to pass the audition of the rest of the band, particularly the bass player, Scott Tunis, who's not an easy guy to please. And in some ways, that was a harder audition to pass than having Frank like me. And, it just worked out. I still can't believe it that I called the office and asked for a job right at the moment when I did. But I'm glad I did because I wouldn't be talking to you now, Meltdown, if I hadn't.
That's right. So did you play with Frank until his passing?
Well, he did that. We did that tour. We rehearsed for 4 months and then we toured for 4 months. And then there were some situations in the band, some psychodrama that brought that band to an unfortunate and premature conclusion. And Frank wasn't feeling well at that point, although he didn't know the extent of his illness. But it was about a year and a half later that he was actually diagnosed. So, he didn't do any more playing after that. I stayed in the Zappa orbit because I ended up joining the band Z, which is a band that Ahmet and Dweezil had called Z at the time. And the bass player from the Frank Zappa band, Scott Tunis, was also in that group. And the drummer eventually was a guy named Joe Travers, And Scott and Joe are also members of the Zappa band that we're about to go on the road with in June. So, you know, it's like I couldn't stop being around Frank as much as possible. So it was important to me to stay in the Zappa orbit. And then, you know, I stayed in Dweezil and Amit's band for another few years. I left that group in 96, and that's when I went and started playing with Steve Vai. So I stayed hanging around Frank for as long as I could.
Yeah, so yeah, your musical history is very impressive. And so do the Zappa boys and the family and stuff, they're giving you the blessing on this Zappa tour?
Yeah, this the way this band came together was an outgrowth of Amit's Bizarre World of Frank Zappa tour, which happened in early 2019, which was, you know, colloquially known as the hologram tour, although the hologram aspect of it was actually just a kind of a small part of the evening. It was actually more of a multimedia, multi-leveled, the mind-blowing tribute to Frank, which ended up being, you know, very emotionally cathartic and really moving for people, but also very expensive to move the technology around. It's like a very elaborate show and a lot of people that need to be paid to operate the equipment. So after that tour ended, there was a desire on the part of the band, you know, many of whom, you know, like I hadn't played with Robert Martin since 1988, and Ray White I had never played with. We got together and we really, you know, there was a rapport there and a desire to keep playing. So we started booking shows at the Baked Potato, which is a jazz club in Los Angeles. And Amit came out to see us there, and he said, "Yeah, man, you've got the spirit. There's obviously this is a valid thing, even you know, disattached from the idea of the Bizarre World of Frank Zappa tour." And then Amit dubbed us the Zappa Band. He gave us that name and said, "Okay, you guys are like the officially sanctioned, you know, Zappa Trust sanctioned Zappa group, and you know, go out in the world." So we were going to start doing a bunch of shows, but then this darn pandemic happened. But you know, once it was possible to start doing shows again last year, we went out opening for King Crimson for a few weeks on what ended up being was very likely their last tour of the United States. So that was a privilege and an amazing experience to come out of lockdown and be, you know, traveling around playing this music for those audiences and in front of this band, Crimson, that I admire and love so much. So that was an amazing experience. Then at the same time, it was kind of a very tightly prescribed situation where we had to play 45 minutes and not a second longer. In fact, in New York City, we had a couple of members of Crimson join us during the show, which was wonderful. But in order to accommodate them, our show ran a little bit long, and we actually got basically the plug pulled in the middle of our final song that night. We were just like, "Oh, man. Okay, we're done. Bye, everybody."
Come on, they couldn't. That sounds insane. That's ridiculous. Can't give a couple extra minutes.
New York City, you know, union rules. There are rules to be adhered to. That's one reason why this tour that we're doing in June, which is the first headline tour we've ever done, is a very special thing to us, because we're going to be able to go out there and be much more relaxed on stage. We'll be changing the show from night to night, because even though we're playing much longer set, we still know more material than we can play in one night. So Zappa freaks who come to multiple shows, which is, you know, that's a real phenomenon, the way it is with the Dead, the way it is with Fish, you know, it's like people want to go out and see a bunch of shows and have a bunch of different experiences. So we want to provide that. We want to make sure that anybody who comes to multiple shows gets to see some different songs from night to night. So, you know, it's going to be very special for us to finally go out and do a bunch of gigs as headliners and just be able to stretch out and relax more on stage and really dig deep into the songs.
It is cool that you belong to this the Zappa fraternity, which is large in some ways but small in others, because it's like there's been many people who have played with Frank over the years, and you're lucky enough to say that you were one of the few people that got to play with him over the years.
Yeah, it is a privilege, you know, and even just to like be in this band now with guys. It's funny, you know, I played with Frank, it was 34 years ago now, 35 practically when I joined the band, but I still consider myself the new guy in this group, because Ray White joined Frank's band in 1976. Robert Martin and Scott Tunis joined the band in 1981. So they've got a number of years on me as being in the Zappa orbit. And I still look up to those guys as the veterans. So it's kind of funny that I sort of occupy two worlds at once as somebody who's been a member of this Zappa fraternity, as you say, for a long time, but still I look up to those guys as the real road dogs, the real Zappa vets. So that's fun.
Yeah, I'm just actually looking on Wikipedia right now as we were just talking about this. The personnel that have played with Frank, I mean, it's like an endless list. But
oh my gosh, yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy. So during the pandemic, like when we were really kind of closed down, I did see that Zappa documentary. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I'm actually in it. That was a pretty mind-blowing thing to be a part of. I think Alex Winter, who directed that, did a fantastic job of putting together a film that would both appeal to the hardcore fan. There's some new insights in there, but also for people who are maybe coming to Frank and his world and his music for the first time. I think that movie is a fantastic introduction. I'm very honored to have been a part of it, and I think Alex did beautiful work with that one.
Yeah, of course you were in it. Why would I even say that?
Well, I mean, I might have been in it and then not seen it. I generally can't bear to watch myself on camera, and I was actually surprised that he stuck as much of me in the movie as he did. But he did a fantastic job with that movie. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did like it a lot. As a matter of fact, I'm a vinyl guy, so now I try to go out and be honest. I'll be honest. Trying to find Frank records is difficult. And then when you do find them, they're expensive. So, but I do have. I think I got four of them right now, and I really like them. I kind of almost discovered Frank just within the last few years. I mean, obviously, I knew him. I've been in this business for 32 years, and obviously I knew Frank. As a matter of fact, my first boss, when I got my first full-time job, actually was a guy named Art Wander. And in the early 1970s, he lived with Frank Zappa for a couple months, I should say, because the radio station wanted him to get the feel for like the underground rock movement in New York City. It's like this crazy story. So anyways, he knew Frank back in the day. So that was like, I mean, obviously I've known about Frank a lot, but I've kind of started to dive into him a little bit more in the past, and I liked it.
Man,
and
there's a lot of diving to be done there.
Cool. There
and
is.
I envy anybody who's like just like really starting to get into the world, because there is a lot there, dude.
Right.
You're gonna have a good time.
Exactly. It's like somebody that's just starting to watch Breaking Bad. You kind of envy him because you've already seen it all.
Exactly.
Yeah. But speaking of. There's a lot to dive into. One of my friends is a huge Zappa fan, and he wanted me to ask you, I mean, how much archival stuff do you think Frank has? I mean, that's kind of a ridiculous question on its face, but I mean, is there like thousands of hours of stuff?
Yes. And what's kind of cool is that the drummer in this band, the Zappa band, Joe Travers, who's also the drummer, he's been the drummer in my band, Beer for Dolphins, on and off since the mid-90s. So Joe and I go way back. He was also the drummer in Dweezil and Amit's band back when I was in that group. But his day gig, the thing that he does for a living when he's not gigging, his title is Vaultmeister, which means it's his job to go into the tape vaults containing all of Frank's tapes, both released and unreleased. And Frank recorded hundreds and hundreds of his shows, and obviously all these studio sessions, many of which these tapes contained songs that were never released. So Joe's been the mastermind behind these archival box sets that have been coming out in the last few years, and they're fantastic. It's like there's so much. Every time you think, well, he's got to have hit the bottom of the well, there's another box that comes out with more unreleased music that you just can't believe, because it's in many cases it's the equal of the stuff that ended up on the real album. Like there was an album that I really loved called Uncle Meat that came out in the late 60s, and Joe went into the vault and found unreleased stuff from those sessions that's just as strong. And like this is like composed material, music that was rehearsed and recorded and orchestrated and thought about that just like sat on this tape unheard for decades. And so Joe's been exhuming this stuff and putting it out. And there's always more to come. There's always, and because I'm Joe's friend, I get to go to his place and he plays me these boxes in progress, like in some cases years before they actually come out. And he's played me some stuff recently that is, not yet seen the light of day, that is absolutely going to blow people's minds. So every time you think that you've heard it all, there's more to come. So, tell your friend, yes.
Yeah, that is amazing. I know that he's got a huge archive, and they actually kind of talked about that a little bit in the documentary. But Franco, he kind of struck me a little bit as the guy who would, write songs, and maybe he'd write – there'd be some songs he'd write, and he'd record them, and that was the last time he'd ever listen to them or hear them. it's like, no, I'm moving on to something different now.
Well, I mean, he considered it, the main thing about that movie was about Frank as composer, right? That was the focus of the film.
Yeah.
And Frank looked at composition in a variety of different ways. He could compose on paper. He could compose on the guitar. He could compose on the piano. He could compose on the computer. He could compose by putting them in a room with a bunch of humans, and he would point at them and make a new piece of music happen spontaneously. But also a part of composition was how you take the elements that you've got and arrange them. And a part of that is what material that you choose to create an album. So he might go in the studio and record 2 hours worth of material, and from that material he's going to compose a 35 minute album. And he'd make the album size kind of short, because on vinyl, if you go if you head too much over 20 minutes, the sound starts to degrade. That's just the nature of the physical medium, which is not a problem that you have with streaming or on a CD. With an album, if you make your vinyl sides too long, it starts to sound shitty. So he would try to make his vinyl sides usually top out around 17, 18 minutes, and sometimes even shorter, like Overnight Sensation and Apostrophe are very short albums.
Yeah.
Apostrophe is like a 31-minute album, but it sounds like heaven when you play it. The songs just jump out of the speakers. So, Frank wanted people to have that. He knew that vinyl was an inherently limited medium physically, so he tried to make the best of it sonically. So that was a part of his composition. He's got, okay, I've got this lump of material I've just spent the last month working on in the studio. What sort of album am I going to create out of this? What you end up with is stuff on the cutting room floor. Some of that ends up on later albums. Some of it just gets stuck in the vault and never gets heard. And that's, Joe Travers' job has been to find some of that unreleased material and finally shine a light on it. In some cases, maybe Frank thought it just wasn't good enough to put out there. We're just blessed at this point as hardcore Zappa fans to have somebody like Joe on the job to say, well, Frank may have felt this way or that way about it, but right now we're in the archives. We are archaeologists, and this stuff is fascinating. And so, it's just a blessing that now Joe is able to share this stuff with us.
Now, the tour starts up in June on the 3rd at the Whiskey A Go-Go and runs throughout the rest of the month. And you're traveling pretty much all across the country. No dates here in the Midwest, so to speak, pretty much on the coast. But people can find you on Facebook at the Zappa Band, the Zappa Band on Instagram and on Twitter as well. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have to follow you guys once I get off the call here with you. But Mike, been a pleasure to talk to you. And this sounds super interesting. And when you come back through the Motor City sometime, hit me up and I'd love to check out the show.
Yeah, I dearly hope that next year we'll be a little more comprehensive in what the markets that we cover. And I'd like nothing better than for you to come out and check it out.
I would definitely go see that. There's no question. By the way, Mike's not the first person I've talked to from the Zappa Circle here on the podcast. I'm at Zappa. Was on sometime last year, I think, promoting maybe even longer than that, promoting the documentary, which we talked about briefly. But yeah, you never know what you're going to get here on the Talking Rock podcast. So I suggest you subscribe, check back often, and follow my pages on social media at Meltdown WRIF on Twitter and Facebook, because I post all these on there. So you can see if there's something that might interest you as far as an artist or a band or something along those lines. With the concerts wrapping up and stuff, I'm thinking I'm going to be getting a lot more interviews coming up this summer as well. As of right now, we'll close out this episode by turning things over to the big guy, as always, This is my friend Pete, and he's going to give you some directions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. You can help this podcast grow by giving it a 5-star rating and writing a review on Apple and iTunes. Plus, feel free to subscribe and share it with your friends. Until next time, thanks for listening to Talkin' Rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.